From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. This past week, Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 47th President of the United States. It has been reported that the new president and his transition team have already indicated interest in radical changes to the Postal Service. These reported musings include privatizing the USPS and have raised serious concern among mail users and members of Congress from both political parties. NAPS, as well as other postal stakeholders, are keeping a close eye on the comments made and policies articulated by the White House and its newly established so-called Department on Government Efficiency. In addition, NAPS is carefully monitoring proposals streaming from the House Budget and the House Ways and Means Committees as part of the congressional budget process. A number of these proposals would slash health and retirement benefits of federal and postal employees and retirees. Among the options that have found their way into the committee documents are raising retirement contributions by 0.8% to 4.4%, eliminate the FERS supplemental retirement payments for those retiring prior to reaching full Social Security eligibility, changing the way in which postal and federal postal retirement is calculating it by basing it, the annuity, on the highest 5 years of service rather than the highest three, imposing a fee on federal and postal employees filing appeals before the Merit Systems Protection Board, and replacing the current health insurance premium formula for calculating the Postal Service Health Benefits Plan and the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program contributions to a fixed dollar voucher. These are all proposals that NAPS takes seriously and will fight. Clearly, the next 3 to 6 months will be very treacherous for the federal and postal community. Nevertheless, new allies were elected to Congress in 2024, and one of them will be joining us today on Naps Chat. So I am pleased to welcome this week's episode of Naps Chat guest, a new member of Congress. He is deeply concerned about postal and the federal workforce and the Postal Service itself, and has emerged as a good friend of Naps. Therefore, I am pleased to welcome Congressman George Latimer of New York to Naps Chat. Welcome, Congressman Latimer.
Bob, thanks very much. A pleasure to be with you and to talk about these issues. Even though it's very early in the session, we have a lot of work ahead of us.
Now, Congressman Latimer represents the 16th District of New York, which is located just north of New York City. Prior to his election, Representative Latimer served as County Executive of Westchester. Prior to that, he was elected to the New York State Legislature and served as a city councilman in the town of Rye. Now, I need to ask you, Congressman, now that you've been a member of the House of Representatives for about 3 weeks, how's the experience been? Is everything the way you thought it would be?
Well, you know, Bob, I've learned over the years as I've had different positions that nothing is ever the way you think it's going to be. There are elements of this experience so far that have been really amazing. I mean, you stand in the well of the House of Representatives, and you're in the room which presidents have given major addresses. Franklin Roosevelt addressed the nation about a day of infamy. Lyndon Johnson addressed the nation after the death of John Kennedy. And that's the physical place where I am going to work when I'm in the chamber. So that is an amazing element. You walk through the halls of Congress as a member, and you kind of pinch yourself. We all have our arc of our lives. I grew up as a blue-collar kid. Dad was a maintenance man. Mom was a factory worker. And the thought that I'm here in Congress is pretty amazing. However, what soberly comes to you is that we have major issues and problems to solutions, and we're in a very difficult time. The election of 2024, by which I became a member of Congress, is also the election that brings a sea change with a new president, new Senate majority, and a small but continuing House majority that are all committed to what I think are more ideological attitudes than they are practical solutions to problems. So we're hearing things just 48 hours into the new president's term that are really well out of the scope of anything that's the right kind of public policy. We're going to have to push back on it. And I guess we'll have to find out, I'll learn as I go along, how much leverage we have in the minority particularly if we can articulate to the American people that we're right on these policies and the other side is wrong.
Now, late last year, you attended orientation, freshman orientation, and you expressed your committee preferences at that point. You participated in the office lottery. We're now in your new office as it's getting up to speed. And you staffed up. What has that experience been like?
Well, it's intriguing because I have had, not only in the public sector, where I've served in five other elected positions before this one, but also in the private sector, where I spent 20 years, which overlapped the beginning of my electoral career. And I've had all different kinds of offices and all different kinds of staffs that I've worked in and around. And you go into these situations sort of understanding where you are in the cosmos. I am a freshman member of this House. I am a member of the minority side of the aisle, and I'm not the youngest freshman legislator. In fact, I'm the oldest. So it creates a certain level of expectation after years of experience that is just sort of rooted in reality. I have a wonderful office. I came somewhere in the middle of the lottery pick, but I had my staff people pick out the best available office, and I didn't worry about it because the office, the physical office is nice, but it's not definitive in terms of the way you do your job. On the committee side, I've been appointed to seats on the Foreign Affairs Committee and on the Small Business Committee. So one foreign, one domestic area for public policy outreach. Because my background in state, county, and city government is very local, being on foreign affairs is a stretch. It's something where I'm now going to be looking at and learning about things that I might have a workman's knowledge of. You and I might read a newspaper, hear a story, and chat about it over a cup of coffee. But now I'm going to be delving much more deeply into foreign matters that will stretch my skill set. On the other side of the coin, small business is an area that I've worked in closely. My tenure as a county executive, we put a lot of time and effort into building our small business to complement major corporations that are based in Westchester County. And of course, we went through the COVID crisis, which rocked all businesses, small and large, to the core. And so I have some experience in that area, hopefully, depending on how the whole House is going to be structured. If we're going to be doing independent legislating and working across the aisle, it'll all work. If it turns out to be that we're going to listen to the dictates of one person, in this case the president, and we're going to do whatever the president wants, then it's going to be a different experience.
Let me visit one of your committee assignments, the Small Business Committee. The small businesses in the United States are very reliant on the United States Postal Service to market their products across the nation and overseas. Tell me what your views are of the Postal Service and how it relates to your constituents.
Well, I see it from a localized basis. I know, you know, the post offices in every community that I represent, I could go to the zip codes, you know, as a matter of rote. I've known many of the local postmasters, and we have long since taken the Postal Service for granted. Its regularity of delivery 6 days a week, its regularity in being able to convey the materials that we need in order to communicate via the mail gets taken for granted. And of course, what happens is whenever there's some problem that it develops, and the problem happens every time, it takes excessive amount of abuse. In some ways, it's become a whipping boy for ideologues that really just don't believe in government, and they want to reduce the size and scope of government carte blanche, whether that government is performing or not. That's where you get the calls for privatization that comes from. I've been involved in government for a long time. I have seen some functions that were done by the private sector that were well managed, but I've seen some that have been utter disasters and should have been kept in the public domain. And I know from my corporate experience that a company performs well when they see a profit margin that's available. In the case of the Postal Service, we're trying to provide a service to the American public. And this goes back to the very founding of the republics and some of the greatest names, the Ben Franklins of the world, that helped define our country. So I think talk about privatizing the Postal Service, playing around with costs to minimize what average individual, hardworking members of the service are compensated or what kind of retirement they have, that's nickel and diming it. And I think it really comes out of an ideology rather than any kind of a practical assessment. Can the Postal Service be improved? Yes, but it's not improved by its downsizing and by demoralizing the workforce. There are different strategies. I don't know if this administration will get to that or not. I hope they do. But if they don't, then we're going to speak up and hope for a different administration in due time.
Your experience has been in local government, state government, now federal government. And there's been a lot of talk of federalism, about how you divvy up responsibilities among the different levels of government. How do you view the federal government power, authority, function as compared to, let's say, to the county, the city of Rye, New York, or the Westchester County, or the state of New York?
Well, the role of the federal government changed dramatically as an outgrowth of fighting the Depression. Franklin Roosevelt, who I considered one of the top presidents in the history of the United States, probably just after Lincoln and Washington, remade the concept of what a federal government should do because it had to get us through the crisis of a financial collapse that would not have been solved by the states. It would not have been solved by private philanthropy or private business. And then we had to fight an amazingly difficult world war. And to have lost either of those two battles, the Depression or the war, would have meant the end of democracy as we know it in this country. So he redefined the role of the federal government. And I think what I'm watching now, 90 years later, is a desire by this new administration to change that back, to define the federal government in minimalist terms, that the federal government will not provide certain services that complements what the local governments can do. When in running the government that I did at the county level, we had a $2.5 billion budget, 4,200 employees, and we had responsibility for waste disposal. We ran an airport and a bus system, and we had policing parkways and special activities. But we could not do all of the things that were possible. We needed state and federal help to do that. And at the state level, the same is true. So the federal government's role has become much more important in the society. Now, some people say, well, that's an obtrusive role. They talk about the deep state. I think that comes from those states in the country that really don't prioritize government. They run minimal states on their own. They have minimal taxation, but they have minimal services. And the people who live in those states apparently like it that way. But I don't want to dumb down the federal government to satisfy that mindset, because only the federal government can effectively do certain things. And interstate activity, commerce, in this case, the mails, has to be done by a robust federal government. The state governments are too inconsistent and uneven in their scope and size.
One of the unique characteristics that you had, if I can turn back the clock to the election season, is that you're one of the few members of Congress who actually beat an incumbent and beat an incumbent in the party primary. Could you talk about how that experience informs how you view politics and how you view your role?
Well, it's an interesting process. I don't consider myself a uniquely egotistical person. We all have to have a certain amount of ego to function in the world. And in this line of work that I'm in, if it's your name on the ballot, you tend to take it personally. But I think to the greater extent, I've tried to be, very low-key and very collegial in the way that I operate and the way I operate in an office context and in my career. I've had a lot of success, in my home area, climbing the greasy pole, as the Brits might say. You indicated some of the positions I've had. But in every one of those situations, I always attended to the jurisdiction that I had. I'm sitting here now representing half of Westchester County and a 70,000-person slice of the Bronx. That is my constituency. I have to attend to that. And no matter that the primary race that I was in was framed as a race about Israel-Gaza, or was framed about money and politics, what the race pivoted on is whether or not the incumbent or myself would better work the district, represent the district, understood the needs of the everyday person, not just some of them. Some of them, fine, but all of them in its diversity, in its 750,000 population diversity. And I think I persuaded people that was the missing link. It wasn't, the national narrative. It was you send somebody to Washington to pay attention to our needs, and that's what I intend to do. It is never easy to be in a primary. I've been in a couple over my career. It's never easy to challenge an incumbent. I've done that a couple of times in my career. Other times I've been the incumbent. But with every one of these things, Bob, what I think the argument is what do you expect in a government employee? Do you expect somebody who is going to have high profile, give speeches, be on television, and sort of strike a pose and be a performance artist? And a lot of people in politics are that, and you have a lot of that here in Washington, because access to the TV cameras, say the outrageous thing, man, you're on TV. But the grassroots of representing people is often very boring and dry, and that is where you prove whether you care or not care. And I think that, to me, is what pivoted the primary and what will either make or break my success in this job.
You were successful as a county executive, and I can identify that. Because you were in charge. You were responsible for getting mm-hmm. the streets cleaned if there was a snowstorm, to get the garbage picked up, to make sure the water flowed. Here, your responsibility is a legislator. You don't have that same authority. How does that change affect you and how you relate to your constituents?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that I spent 30 years as a legislator before I became an executive. And of course, you'd have to delve into the politics of Westchester County in 2017. But the concern was, oh, he's never been an executive. Can he actually govern something? And I had chaired the county legislature before that. That showed some level of executive authority in running a legislative body. And I had shown that in my private sector. But, you know, so I had to convince people that I could be an effective county executive. Now, having convinced them that I was an effective county executive, I have to go back to the legislative mindset, which is different. You cannot by your own hand point and watch something come to pass. And I've had that experience as an executive. What I also don't have is I don't have the responsibility of making all the numbers line up and all the people and union contracts be satisfied. We've negotiated union contracts during my prior job. We did so successfully, but it was never easy. You had to work through it. And I don't have those responsibilities now. But what I do have as a legislator is I now have the sensitivity of knowing that when I advocate for something, when I put a bill out there, somebody's got to take a bill and turn this into an actual governmental program or policy. It's got to be administered by people in the real world. And perhaps the experience as county executive, there's colleagues of mine now that have mayors, were other executives in other ways, that gives us a depth when we legislate to understand that it's more than just, I voted for something and then I go out and have a drink and dinner, that I voted for something, but now it has to actually come to pass. And how do you make sure that what you vote on and what you create is something that can be implemented? And that, I think, is a different dynamic.
What's interesting is that we've had a number of presidents of the United States who went from the governor's mansion to the presidency and did a reasonably effective job in getting things done. George W. Bush was a governor. Jimmy Carter, who recently passed away, was a governor. Ronald Reagan was a governor. And the list goes down. Does that skill set make you better appreciate not only the legislative process, but how the legislative process can impact individuals, American citizens?
I think it begins with what your philosophy of government is. I accept the fact that we are in a democratic form of government and a republic in which there is a reason for a legislature and the reason for an executive branch, and there's a check and a balance. There was many times that I sat as an executive frustrated by the legislative body. It's a unicameral legislature, Westchester County Legislature. Good people all, both sides of the aisle. All of them I consider friends. When I see them now, I greet them warmly. I was a member of that body previously, and I chaired that body. But as an executive, I wanted to do certain things, and sometimes I didn't have the legislative support to do it, and that could be irritating. Now, as a legislator, what do I want flipping it around? You know, I want to see an executive be successful because I want the United States of America to be successful. But I'd like to know that we do provide a check and balance. We don't need to be a rubber stamp for a president. We don't need to say, well, politically, he's kind of popular. He won an election. He gets to do anything he wants. I've won elections that never gave me a blank check. If anything, I think an election is a promissory note where you get elected and you say, okay, I promise to you I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, some of the specific things I said in the campaign trail, and then in general to try to advance the best interests of the people in the jurisdiction. So I think the correlation, you know, from having been both an executive and a legislator leads me well here, but I recognize that, you know, President Trump did not serve in any public office other than being president of the United States. He was a developer in New York City at some level, and he was a TV personality. And through that personality, he was able to capture a style that drew attention far beyond people who were in offices. When he won in 16, he beat a field of Republicans that included governors and senators. But he understood the zeitgeist from his TV roles, and people saw him in the light of a person who could be an executive. And, of course, he had his first term, and now he's back for second term. And we'll see how that all goes. But I guess the situation, Bob, is many governors have become excellent presidents. Franklin Roosevelt comes to mind. But Abraham Lincoln, you know, could be charitably called a failed politician prior to his presidency, with a term here of this and a term there of that. Dwight Eisenhower wasn't in politics, but he was at a high level of the military, and he understood how to organize and accomplish things. So what I think the test of this administration is going to be is not his ability to rally, to articulate, oh, this, and make fun of that, and people laugh, and they clap, and they're ready to vote for him. But can he actually accomplish something at the end of the day? Some of the proposals he's talking about for the Postal Service will cause a diminution in the result. And the result is you won't get your mail in a timely fashion. You will have problems with coverage of areas. People who are otherwise capable, people might say, I'm not going to put up with this. I'm going to leave, which is perhaps what he wants. So I think in the short term, there's the heady nature of winning an election. I've won quite a few in my life. And you think, oh, I can do anything I want. And then the sobering reality comes in that you can't think that way. You have to think collegially. You have to work with other people. And you have to look at something and say, if we can make it better, let's make it better. But let's not just wreck it because it's here in this form. And some people don't like it. And by the way, if I can change everything, I go down in American history.
Let me ask you about your legislative priorities. And this will be the final question.
Sure.
What are your legislative priorities? And at some point in the future when you decide you'd like to leave Congress, what would your correct congressional legacy mean to you?
Well, I think I have to be realistic. In a large legislative body, you're going to do things personally on the margin. If I can be part of a group of people that accomplishes some of these things, then that would be helpful. I think in terms of what I heard during my campaign for Congress from everyday people, and it didn't matter whether they were black or white or Latino, Asian, it didn't matter if they were gay or straight, didn't matter whether they were old or young. They wanted to see their lives made better. And that's a very vague thing. It means different things to different people. But certainly the economy, the cost of consumer goods, food, fuel, the cost of health care, the fear over crime, whether it's actual crime or just the fear of the potential of it, those things and others were what was on people's minds. So what I'd like to be able to do for whatever length of time I'm here is to contribute to addressing some of those issues. I have ideas. Some of them will show up in legislation. Some of them will show up when we argue over money. Whether they'll be heard in this first term, given the political construct, is anybody's guess. But I do think that the one thing I can absolutely guarantee as a legacy is that I'm going to be oriented to representing my district in an aggressive and omnipresent way so that people say, you know, we sent that guy to Congress, but we didn't feel like he left us. He was still with us. And that will help. And if you're with members in your district every day, then you're talking to the guy who lives on the street who happens to be a postal worker, who happens to know how the system works better than you do. And over a cup of coffee, you can say, George, let me tell you what the real problems are here. Or let me tell you how I've been in this system for 35 years. Let me tell you what I think I would do. If you get that kind of local grassroots connection, you can have those relationships in every one of these endeavors, not just Postal Service, you'll be a much better congressman for it. And I hope to be a good congressman.
I wish more congressmen felt that way. I want to thank Congressman George Latimer for joining us on Naps Chat today. Thank you, Congressman Latimer.
Thank you, Bob. It's a real pleasure.
And I want to thank our Naps Chat listeners for logging on. If you enjoy Naps Chat, please leave us a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store or the platform of your choice. And more importantly, share Naps Chat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe and stay healthy.
I'll sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe.